In addition to all the free publicity, Disney spent about $70 million marketing the film in the United States. For the premiere, the Navy brought the USS John C. Stennis aircraft carrier from San Diego to Honolulu. Disney screened the film on board. Navy SEALs parachuted onto the deck as F-15 fighters flew in formation overhead. Veterans of the Pearl Harbor attack were flown in as special guests. The Honolulu Symphony Pops provided music. After the screening, Disney staged a fireworks display. The tab came to $5 million. Given all the hype that preceded it, it was indeed news when Pearl Harbor opened to scathing reviews and disappointing box office, at least by the inflated standards of the pre-opening publicity fueled by Eisner's boasts. The headline in the Wall Street Journal was, "Snora, Snora, Snora." Roger Ebert wrote that Pearl Harbor was a two-hour movie squeezed into 3 hours. Its centerpiece is 40 minutes of special effects, surrounded by a love story of stunning banality. No studio had dared challenge the Pearl Harbor juggernaut, so it was the only major movie opening over the lucrative Memorial Day weekend, traditionally the start of the summer movie season. It earned $75 million over the Memorial Day weekend, a more than respectable opening. But the box office plunged in ensuing weeks. Especially galling for Eisner was that the big hit of the summer and the top-grossing film of the year was Shrek, a computer-generated fairy tale based on a William Steig novel produced by Jeffrey Katzenberg at DreamWorks, which had opened just a few weeks earlier. With benefit of hindsight, it's hard to know what, besides wishful thinking, could have led to such hubris at Disney about Pearl Harbor. The film faced obvious hurdles, starting with a running time of close to 3 hours. Its length, its romantic plot, and the backdrop of tragedy invited unfavorable comparisons to the wildly successful Titanic. And surely Disney executives could sense that, however earnest and patriotic or dazzling the special effects, the storytelling, the quality to which Eisner paid so much tribute, was flawed. Todd Garner, whose idea it was, had said he didn't like the finished script or film, but by then no one was listening to him. Schneider's plan to exit under the halo effect of a summer blockbuster was ruined. He decided to wait until the release of Atlantis, The Lost Empire, the latest animated feature scheduled for June, even though he had never liked the film. Directed by the same team that produced Beauty and the Beast, Atlantis was a departure from the musical genre, an attempt to appeal to pre-teenage boys with an Indiana Jones-style adventure film, a quest for the lost continent. Atlantis garnered admiring reviews, but was hopelessly eclipsed by the success of Shrek, which took direct aim at the Disney canon with its edgy, irreverent send-up of the fairy tale genre. Atlantis didn't earn back its nearly $100 million cost and became the latest in a growing string of animated disappointments from Disney. These developments were especially worrisome to John Musker and Ron Clements, who were deep into work on Treasure Planet, another attempt at an action-adventure animated feature. Their target audience of preteen and teenage boys apparently still associated hand-drawn 2D animation with children's fare and wanted no part of it. And other animators feared for their futures. Schumacher met with 2,000